Content warning, today's episode of So Many Books, So Little Time, Joseph Heller's Catch-22, Chapter 5, contains references to the exploitation and persecution of Indigenous peoples, racial vilification and slurs, which we do edit out, however they are implied, some language that is somewhat sanist and discusses mental health in a very difficult to parse methods with language that is not censored, and generally also war and death and violence, as you would expect in a novel about war and death and violence.
Hey folks, Dave here.
Andrew.
And welcome to So Many Books,
So Little Time.
Please join us for Chapter 5 of Catch-22 by Joseph Heller. Morning, Rue. I'm not going to go into a Good Morning Vietnam diversion again.
No.
How are you doing?
Relatively okay. Trying to coordinate a million things at the same time, as you do.
Full-time job.
Full-time job. Trying to deal with your health and your studies and community, and yeah, it's a bit lot. Too much.
Too much better not.
Too much.
Hey, have you been reading anything of interest lately?
My current reading content is very much related to uni work. And yeah, it's a lot of uni work, a lot of teaching, so preparing materials for the teaching spaces. And also my study spaces. I have probably not been reading much for pleasure. I finished, as we know, finished off the Dresden Files up to now. We had a nice discussion on that, our personal time.
Mm-hmm.
And now Dave can discuss the Dresden Files with me without worrying about being a spoiler maker. So no, it's good.
I was excited because, before Rue had finished reading and we had that talk, I had nobody to talk about those books with. There are people in my friend circle who do read Dresden. They're the ones that got me into it originally. But it seems, because there's been a 6-year hiatus between the last book and this one, they all kind of fell off the bandwagon. And I kind of stuck with it, reread them, listened to that unspoiled podcast. So, I was ready to jump right back into it. And I think some of these other folks just felt they were too far removed from the series, and they felt they couldn't go back into it without kind of a revision of what had happened.
Which, yeah, I can understand that, because you lose the momentum of what's going on in terms of the story. Like, who is that again? I don't remember. What was their relationship? I don't remember.
And one of the big criticisms of at least Peace Talks, which two books came out last year, which were supposed to be one book, but Peace Talks was the first of them, was that it introduced characters that if you read the side stories, the short stories that Jim writes everywhere, you would be familiar with who these characters were. But in the main story, he just kind of name drops them and introduces them, and you're supposed to know who they are. And that can be off-putting for some folks.
Well, yes, we need an anthology of all the short stories in one collection. That'd be very helpful.
Oh, there are two of them, but one thing I did want to talk about I finished a book last week, called The Children's Bible by Lydia Millett. It's a 2020 book. It was on, I found a list of like the best books from 2020. I've been going through it.
I see.
And it's one of those books where I finished it, and I've been thinking about the book ever since I finished it. So parts of it have been staying with me. I'll just set up the premise, and I do give a recommendation for anyone. This was quite the ride. A bunch of children and their parents, like their parents are wealthy. They've rented like a summer house. Mm-hmm. For the kids range from, you know, like very young to 17, but most of them are teenagers. Most of the main characters are teenagers of one variety or another. And the parents have done that thing where to make sure their kids have a good summer vacation, they've locked all their phones away in a safe. Mm. And the kids already do not have a good impression of their parents. And and basically, so they're hanging out, they're occupying themselves with silly games. They're showing a lot of disdain for how the adults are behaving. And then disaster strikes, and the story kind of moves on from there. And it goes places, man. It's quite the ride.
I see. So we'll put that on the... Maybe is that something to read list?
Cause... Well, it's a very new book. We won't be able to do that for a long time.
Oh, not here.
Right, yeah. No, I recommend you read it in your own time. Definitely, definitely. Because just like Dresden, it'd be cool to have someone to discuss that book with. Because, bits of it have stuck with me. There's bits of it I don't like. But, you know, when you watch, when you read, when you listen to something, and you find yourself thinking about it afterwards, I think that's the mark of something worthwhile. Something about it has hit you. It's stayed with you. You've taken something from it.
Something stuck. Yeah, it's been... I know that there's a lot of people who would like to read, but then they just get exhausted, and I'm debating maybe getting some audiobooks to listen to when I'm needing to rest my eyes, so to speak.
Audiobooks are so... Like, I subscribe to Audible just mainly for their... Every month, if you're a member, they give you, like, the Editor's Choice audiobook, and just having, like, a book from the zeitgeist that I get to listen to when I'm walking and at the cafe is great. This month's book, I'm only a chapter in, but it's the first Bridgerton novel, which you mentioned when we were reading Northanger Abbey.
There's parallels.
Very popular on Netflix. And I was walking and listening to the prologue, and the prologue made me very, very angry. And I'm like, good. I'm feeling emotion. Okay, this is going to be a ride. So that'll be interesting. Actually, last month was an Australian book called The Wife and the Widow. I think I brought it up here on the podcast before. That ended up
mentioned
being a very interesting mystery when all was said and done, for those of you who like crime fiction. Yeah, I thought that was... And the thing with an audiobook as well is you've got the added layer of the performance of the narrator. Which can make or break the book, really, which is why Rue and I have such anxiety when we're reading our prospective books for this podcast. Because I don't know if... Maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, Rue, but when I read, I'm always in the back of my mind, am I communicating the book well enough?
I think, that's part of it. And also, it's like, is this... How it sounds like in my head and how I read it out loud might not always match. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, okay, well, look, it was close enough. It's like, I just have to accept it and move on.
And for me, the rhythms of the sentences and the words are very important. When I go back and edit these, I hear the kind of sing-songy nature I have, especially when there's a long sentence. And I kind of, a lot of authors don't like excessive comma use, but they use long sentences. So I kind of have to find my own place to put the commas, to take those pauses.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I've been finding, with Northanger Abbey, I think the tone that I read it in was very influenced by the telemovie. I noticed that afterwards as well. I'm like, I think I'm, like, it's not obvious, but to me it is.
Right.
But yes, it might be obvious to someone else who watches the televised interpretation by ITV.
Gotcha.
So, but... Yes, so it's difficult, but we try. I mean, there was something that came up last. So David, in the middle of editing, notices a line that was read, but we didn't really discuss.
Yeah. Oh. Yes.
And it's funny, and it's probably part of it was because of the way it's written. It was in that wall of things that were happening.
Well, that's the thing. Like, when I talk about run-on sentences, I'm kind of throwing shade at Joseph Heller because as I'm going through and editing out every time I tripped up and over a sentence, a lot of them were in that last chapter. And yet, Just to set up the line, it was when they were talking about the educational classes that were being held, and Yessarian was he and his fellow officers were mucking up, and when the book was explaining the educational classes, they talked about how everyone knew there was a subversive among the men in these classes, and the colonel knew this man was a subversive because here's basically paraphrasing the line, because he liked Adolf Hitler, and Hitler had done such a good job of rooting out anti-American sentiment in Germany. And re-listening to that line as I read it, as I'm editing, I just like, root, oh my God, check out this line. Oh, what? Because when you think of what he's actually saying, you're like, oh.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out who is who. Like, it's like, so Yessarian knew, so Clevenger had once conducted two nights a week in Captain Black's intelligence test with the corporal in eyeglasses. So it's referring to the corporal in eyeglasses, whom everyone knew was probably a subversive. So Captain Black knew that he was a subversive because he wore eyeglasses and uses Panacea, Utopia, and disapproved of Adolf Hitler. I'm like, wow. Mate, who's Captain Black for here?
Well, to spell that to me, the way I read that line is that, you know, Hitler's been very good at rooting out anti-American sentiment in Germany. It's like, who's the people that Hitler's been eradicating and removing from Germany?
Yeah, the Jewish people. It wasn't just the Jewish people, but that's the whole point. Obviously, very much so, the majority were those who are Jewish. But there was more. It was like the disabled, the Roma, it was a huge pile.
Yeah, the idea, if you're not a strong white man, you're not American.
Yes, and I think that was more the telling things like that idea of it's interesting that Heller snuck that in.
It really does feel like a sneak, because that's something we definitely would have talked about for a while last episode.
Well, I think Heller's sneaking in this commentary of the people who are providing the intelligence and making the decisions are heavily influenced by like this white supremacist ideal of America.
Well, also the war propaganda.
Yes, and the war, it's just a mess. But anyway, it's interesting to see. We haven't looked into why America didn't get involved in World War II sooner, but yeah. So it is also because there's a lot of information that supports the idea that a lot of the decisions made in America, in Germany, were actually modeled off America.
And there was a lot of support for what Third Reich were doing in the States.
Yes. So they were actually modeling. So all the really, really bad stuff we hear about Nazis were literally modeled off what was happening in the States.
Yep.
Normally.
Yeah, it's a wonderful part of American history, and that's very sarcastic, in case you can't tell from my voice.
That's sarcasm, folks, not serious. Yes, it's terrible.
But that does lead us into discussing what happened in the last chapter. It was about Dr. Nika, and we did the first part of the chapter did let us know a little more about almost what a the word I want to say is pathetic. He's a very woe is me person.
Well, no, he's just a weasel.
Okay.
He's a weasel. Like, he reminds me, this is bad because I'm going to refer to everything in relation to MASH, and people who don't watch MASH are going to go, what? Anyway, so there's a character in the first seasons of MASH called Frank Burns, and Dr. Nika reminds me of Frank Burns.
Okay.
Like, because Frank Burns is all very, although Frank Burns is also this idea of playing the military game, like, oh, because he's getting, like, he gets treated with respect. It's not that he doesn't want to be there. But then the way he complains about the fact that when he was back home, like, he's a terrible doctor. He's a terrible doctor. Actually, Frank Burns meets some of the things that Hawkeye complains about, who's the other main character, and other people who complain about being drafted and not wanting to be there. But the difference is that in MASH, like, those ones who do complain about not wanting to be there, they prioritize the treating of people and their patients and making sure that they're okay. Whereas Frank, it was all about how he's perceived and how he's treated and being able to, like, it's a mess. Anyway, right. I can see a few of the MASH characters kind of in from this.
Hmm.
Yeah, he's, and then all the other descriptions of this idea of T.S. Eliot. That was funny.
T.S. Eliot, that was funny. I edited that part last night and I was laughing about it all over again.
Because T.S. Eliot, that bit is funny. It's like going back and forth and just like being absolutely, it's just a mess. And then I think Whittinger? What was his name?
Wintergreen, PFC Wintergreen.
Thank you. Yeah, so Wintergreen having that kind of almost cheeky effect on the dialogue between them, knowing exactly what he's doing. Like, he's causing chaos, but it's not harmful. And what harmful.
I love is that when Peckham is trying to understand what's going on, he does call Wintergreen, because he's like, that guy knows what's up.
Oh, it's just a mess.
But also another thing about Dr. Nika was that he has those two underlings who he's kind of fobbed off all his duties on. They're the ones that are taking everyone's temperature, and they have the rules in place for what happens when people are above 102, when they're below 102, and when they're exactly 102. And
it's implied that they intimidate as well.
Well, he thinks they're too good at their job, but yet not enough, because they keep saying he's perfectly fine, so he's thinking about sending them back to the motor pool where he got them from.
Yeah, so he doesn't want to stay. He's looking for ways to escape.
And the Yossarian's faking his flight time for him.
Yes, and then when he's telling him, you scratched your back, scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. Whenever a Yossarian asks for a favor, he doesn't get one. So it's like... Yeah. Really? Yes. So we're continuing, I think, today with chapter 5, which is great.
With Let's see.
Chief White Half-Oat. Half-Oat?
Half-Oat.
Half-Oat. Not a whole oat. Not a complete oat. A half-oat.
I don't think we've encountered this character before.
No, we haven't.
Chapter 5, Chief White Half-Oat. Dr. Nika lived in a splotched gray tent with Chief White Half-Oat, whom he feared and despised. I can just picture his liver, Dr. Nika grumbled. Picture my liver, Yossarian advised him. There's nothing wrong with your liver. That shows how much you don't know, Yossarian bluffed, and told Dr. Nika about the troublesome pain in his liver that had troubled Nurse Duckett and Nurse Kramer and all the doctors in the hospital, because it wouldn't become jaundice and wouldn't go away. Dr. Nika wasn't interested. You think you've got troubles, he wanted to know. What about me? You should have been in my office the day those newlyweds walked in. What newlyweds? Those newlyweds that walked into my office one day. Didn't I ever tell you about them? She was lovely. So was Dr. Nika's office. He had decorated his waiting room with goldfish and one of the finest suites of cheap furniture. Whatever he could, he bought on credit, even the goldfish. For the rest, he obtained money from greedy relatives in exchange for shares of the profits. His office was in Staten Island in a two-family fire trap just 4 blocks away from the ferry stop and only 1 block south of a supermarket, 3 beauty parlors, and 2 corrupt druggists. It was a corner location, but nothing helped. Population turnover was small, and people clung through habit to the same physicians they had been doing business with for years. Bills piled up rapidly, and he was soon faced with the loss of his most precious medical instruments. His adding machine was repossessed, and then his typewriter. The goldfish died. Fortunately, just when things were blackest, the war broke out. It was a godsend, Dr. Nika confessed solemnly. Most of the other doctors were soon in the service, and things picked up overnight.
Yeah, it's terrible.
That's why the war was a godsend.
Yeah, it was all about him. Yeah.
Yeah. The corner location really started paying off, and I soon found myself handling more patients than I could handle competently. I upped my kickback fee with those 2 drugstores. The beauty parlors were good for 2-3 abortions a week. Things couldn't have been better. And then look what happened. They had to send a guy from the draft board around to look me over. I was 4F. I had examined myself pretty thoroughly and discovered that I was unfit for military service. You'd think my word would be enough, wouldn't you? Since I was a doctor in good standing with my county medical society and with my local Better Business Bureau. But no, it wasn't, and they sent this guy around just to make sure I really did have one leg amputated at the hip and was helplessly bedridden with incurable rheumatoid arthritis.
So funny.
Yusarian, we live in an age of distrust and deteriorating spiritual values. It's a terrible thing. Oh, Dr. Nika protested in a voice quavering with strong emotion. It's a terrible thing when even the word of a licensed physician is suspected by the country he loves.
Can I just point out, this is actually really funny, because it is a thing that continues even now, that clinicians are not listened to when, like, by government, and it's frustrating, because it is actually a problem.
But then there are physicians like him, I imagine.
Then you've got this fictional situation, which, I mean, it's not entirely fictional. I'm sure to avoid being drafted, people would have been a bit funny. And, I mean, this guy's, he's even saying, I was handling more patients than I could handle competently. He's the example of a physician that, I actually think that Heller's had a really bad hospital experience because of the way he writes about medical, sorry, the way he writes about the hospital, the way he writes about illness, the way he writes about physicians. Yeah. There's some unprocessed trauma being processed here, and it's very clear.
And I think when I briefly looked at the Wikipedia last episode, it said that his parents owned a drugstore, so maybe he had dealings with the shady side. It was in Brooklyn as well.
Yeah. I think he's seen some of the underbelly of what, like, the history of healthcare and the history of medicine particularly. There are some very deep, dark pockets, mm-hmm. just well, like with all industries, really.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Engineering, you've got the pyramids and the deaths that are involved in it. So if you think about it that way, everything has got that history that is not particularly clean.
Well, and the thing is, like, his excuse had to be so stupid, you know, amputation, rheumatoid arthritis, when he could have been like Yusarian and just complained about jaundice in his liver.
Yep. Yeah. There could be stuff going, it's frustrating.
So, Dr. Nika had been drafted and shipped to Pianosa as a flight surgeon, even though he was terrified of flying. I don't have to go looking for trouble in an airplane, he noted, blinking his beady brown offended eyes myopically. Now, that's a great sentence.
Yeah, it's great.
It comes looking for me, like that virgin I'm telling you about that couldn't have a baby. What virgin? Yusarian asked. I thought you were telling me about some newlyweds. That's the virgin I'm telling you about. They were just a couple of young kids, and they'd been married, a little over a year when they came walking into my office without an appointment. You should have seen her. She was so sweet and young and pretty. She even blushed when I asked her about her periods. I don't think I'll ever stop loving that girl. She was built like a dream and wore a chain around her neck with a medal of St. Anthony hanging down inside the most beautiful bosom I never saw. It must be a terrible temptation for St. Anthony, I joked, just to put her at ease, you know. St. Anthony, her husband said. Who's St. Anthony? Ask your wife, I told him. She can tell you who St. Anthony is. Who is St. Anthony, he asked her. Who, she wanted to know. St. Anthony, he told her. St. Anthony, she said. Who's St. Anthony? When I got a good look at her inside my examination room, I found she was still a virgin. I spoke to her husband alone while she was pulling her girdle back on and hooking it onto her stockings. Every night, he boasted. A real wise guy, you know. I never miss a night, he boasted. He meant it, too. I've even been putting it to her mornings before the breakfast she makes me before we go to work, he boasted. There was only one explanation. When I had them both together again, I gave them a demonstration of intercourse with the rubber models I've got in my office. I've got these rubber models in my office with all the reproductive organs of both sexes that I keep locked up in separate cabinets to avoid a scandal. I mean, I used to have them. I don't have anything anymore, not even a practice. The only thing I have now is this low temperature that I'm really starting to worry about. Those two kids I've got working for me in the medical tent aren't worth a damn as diagnosticians. All they know how to do is complain. They think they've got troubles? What about me? They should have been in my office that day with those two newlyweds looking at me as though I were telling them something nobody'd ever heard of before. You never saw anybody so interested. You mean like this, he asked me, and worked the models for himself a while. You know, I can see where a certain type of person might get a big kick out of doing just that. That's it, I told him. Now you go home and try it my way for a few months and see what happens, okay? Okay, they said, and paid me in cash without any argument. Have a good time, I told them, and they thanked me and walked out together. He had his arm around her waist as though he couldn't wait to get her home and put it to her again. A few days later, he came back all by himself and told my nurse he had to see me right away. As soon as we were alone, he punched me in the nose. He did what? He called me a wise guy and punched me in the nose. What are you, a wise guy? He said, and knocked me flat on my ass. Pow, just like that. I'm not kidding. I know you're not kidding, Yesarian said. But why did he do it? How should I know why he did it? Dr. Nika retorted with annoyance. Maybe it had something to do with St. Anthony? Dr. Nika looked at Yesarian blankly. St. Anthony? He asked with astonishment. Who's St. Anthony? I just looked at Rue, and Rue was like, ugh. How should I know? Answered Chief White Half-Oat, staggering inside the tent just then with a bottle of whiskey cradled in his arm and sitting himself down pugnaciously between the two of them. Dr. Nika rose without a word and moved his chair outside the tent, his back bowed by the compact kit of injustices that was his perpetual burden. He could not bear the company of his roommate. Chief White Half-Oat thought he was crazy. I don't know what's the matter with that guy, he observed reproachfully. He's got no brains. That's what's the matter with him. If he had any brains, he'd grab a shovel and start digging. Right here in the tent, he'd start digging, right under my cot. He'd strike oil in no time. Didn't he know that enlisted men struck oil with a shovel back in the States? Didn't he ever hear what happened to that kid? What was the name of that rotten rat bastard pimp of a snot-nose back in Colorado? Wintergreen. Wintergreen. He's afraid, Yesarian explained. Oh no, not Wintergreen, Chief White Half-Oat shook his head with undisguised admiration. That stinking little punk wise guy son of a bitch ain't afraid of nobody. Dr. Neek is afraid. That's what's the matter with him. What's he afraid of? He's afraid of you, Yesarian said. He's afraid you're going to die of pneumonia. He'd better be afraid, Chief White Half-Oat said. A deep, low laugh rumbled throughout his massive chest. I will too, the first chance I get. You just wait and see. Chief White Half-Oat was a handsome, swarthy Indian from Oklahoma with a heavy, hard-boned face and tousled black hair. A half-blooded Creek from Enid, who, for occult reasons of his own, had made up his mind to die of pneumonia. He was a glowering, vengeful, disillusioned Indian who hated foreigners with names like Cathcart, Korn, Black, and Havermeyer, and wished they'd all go back to where their lousy ancestors had come from. You wouldn't believe it, Yesarian, he ruminated, raising his voice deliberately to bait Dr. Nika. But this used to be a pretty good country to live in before they lashed it up with their goddamn piety. Chief White Half-Oat was out to revenge himself upon the white man. He could barely read or write and had been assigned to Captain Black as assistant intelligence officer.
Pause. Yeah? Captain Black. Remember, this is the same Captain Black who's very pro-Hitler.
Or just anti-intelligence because of the educational brief. So we got a man who can't read or write being an assistant intelligence officer for Captain Black.
Yeah, but how much of that is because they don't like Captain Black somewhere else in the chain as well?
Could be.
Or he wants to keep the information that he has secret.
I mean, there's a lot of pettiness, the like little snipes between General Dreedle and General Peckham.
So yeah.
It just seems like everybody's got a problem with someone else in this whole outfit.
Individualism, extreme, but yes.
How could I learn to read or write? Chief White Half-Oat demanded with simulated belligerence, raising his voice again so that Dr. Nika would hear. Every place we pitched our tent, they sank an oil well. Every time they sank a well, they hit oil. And every time they hit oil, they made us pack up our tent and go someplace else. We were human divining rods. Our whole family had a natural affinity for petroleum deposits. And soon, every oil company in the world had technicians chasing us around. We were always on the move. It was one hell of a way to bring a child up, I can tell you. I don't think I ever spent more than a week in one place. His earliest memory was of a geologist. Sorry, that's just a silly sentence. I love that. Every time another White Half-Oat was born, he continued, the stock market turned bullish. Soon, whole drilling crews were following us around with all their equipment just to get the jump on each other. Companies began to merge just so they could cut down on the number of people they had to assign to us. But the crowd in back of us kept growing. We never got a good night's sleep. When we stopped, they stopped. When we moved, they moved. Chuck wagons, bulldozers, derricks, generators. We were a walking business boom. and we began to receive invitations from some of the best hotels just for the amount of business we would drag into town with us. Some of those invitations were mighty generous, but we couldn't accept any because we were Indians, and all the best hotels that were inviting us wouldn't accept Indians as guests.
Oop.
Racial prejudice is a terrible thing, Yessarian. It really is. It's a terrible thing to treat a decent, loyal Indian like a or I'm not saying any of those.
Good job. They're basically a whole bunch of slurs regarding various ethnicities.
Mm. Chief White Half-Oat nodded slowly with conviction. Then, Yessarian, it finally happened. The beginning of the end. They began to follow us around from in front. They would try to guess where we were going to stop next and would begin drilling before we even got there, so we couldn't stop. As soon as we'd begin to unroll our blankets, they would kick us off. They had confidence in us. They wouldn't even wait to strike oil before they kicked us off. We were so tired we almost didn't care the day our time ran out. One morning, we found ourselves completely surrounded by oilmen, waiting for us to come their way so they could kick us off. Everywhere you looked, there was an oilman on a ridge, waiting there like Indians getting ready to attack. It was the end. We couldn't stay where we were because we had just been kicked off, and there was no place left for us to go. Only the army saved me. Luckily, the war broke out just in the nick of time, and a draft board picked me up right out of the middle and put me down safely in Lower East Field, Colorado. I was the only survivor. Yessarian knew he was lying, but did not interrupt, as Chief White Half-Oat went on to claim that he had never heard from his parents again. That didn't bother him too much, though, for he had only their word for it that they were his parents, and since they had lied to him about so many other things, they could just as well have been lying to him about that, too. He was much better acquainted with the fate of a tribe of first cousins who had wandered away north in a diversionary movement and pushed inadvertently into Canada. When they tried to return, they were stopped at the border by American immigration authorities who would not let them back into the country. They could not come back in because they were red.
Just gonna say, that's a thing. That's a legitimate thing as well that happens. Which
oh, chasing folks over borders and then not letting them back in.
Yeah, there's part of that. And also, for a long, long time, I think at this time, there would have been no citizenship. Because he would have been classed as... So the way that Native Americans are treated is a whole level of disturbing and terrible. And the same with the Canadian First Nations. Like, everything is very terrible.
Basically how any colonizer treats the First Nations of that country.
Yes.
Australia, yes. Too.
All of them.
Yep.
And one of the things that came up is they'll do things like they wouldn't give them a passport, they wouldn't give them citizenship, they wouldn't give them records. And so because they also, various Indigenous peoples, those who have a nomadic tendency where there are certain trails that are part of literally their life, they don't, those borders that are introduced by colonizers are not relevant to them.
Yeah.
And so there's that, this kind of description is not too surprising that it would happen. It's terrible and it's horrible and it still happens to some extent. That's why when people, you know, the current border against Mexico, that's a problem because there are people that whose lands and whose ancestry and whose patterns are all over that spot, and the border is just an introduced thing, and it's
I know from the little history of that region I do that the borders were very flexible for a long time as territory was went back and forth between America and Mexico over the years.
And then and then you've got this arbitrary like you've got people whose ancestors and family are just split all over the place. And then if you are Indigenous and you are on one side of the border and say you accidentally or you ended up on the other side of the border, coming back in can be a pain.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people who just get arbitrarily locked up because, oh, well, you look different, therefore you must be from...
yeah,
it's bad. It's very bad. Aside from the disproportionate incarceration of Indigenous peoples around the world.
Yep.
Which Australia is leading on, which is a whole nother thing.
We...
Yay! Yeah, so that topic. And it's interesting that Heller's brought it up. He's even mentioning it is actually interesting.
And, well, also that Yessarian thinks he's lying about at least some of the story.
I'm sure it's not entirely accurate, but it's...
I think he said more he's lying about, like, he didn't even know his parents, really. And he's like, that bit's got to be.
The point that he's probably saying is that he's not sure if his parents are his parents, and that can be a thing. Because there's different cultural approaches towards raising children. In some cultures, you give your child to your cousins, and the cousins give their child to you.
And I'm just thinking also, it kind of is a fantastic story about, you know, the oil men were chasing us because every time we stopped to sleep, we'd strike oil when they came, and then they started going in front of us. So there was just oil men everywhere. It sounds very fantastical.
Except that it's probably accurate to some extent. Maybe not in the way he's describing it. But that's essentially what happens. The people get chucked to fewer, sent off to the margins and chased away until they live in like a land.
I'm not disputing that part. More the idea of, you know, companies upon companies, and then them trying to predict where they go. And
The way that they are writing it in here, though, it's interesting. Like, this is their families implying that initially they were actually working well with them.
Mm.
That they were doing it as like a service, like it was how they worked, and because it's a terrible thing to treat a decent, loyal Indian like. Blah, blah, blah. So we're doing all the right things. We're trying to appease these people, and yet they'll still treat us like crap. So no matter how much you appease the oppressor, it's not going to make a difference. It won't fix things. It's not actually going to keep you safe. And I think that's kind of what's happening in this story, is depicting that, but in their own sense.
Yeah. It was a horrible joke, but Doc Danica didn't laugh until Yessarian came to him one mission later and pleaded again, without any real expectation of success, to be grounded. Doc Danica sniggered once and was soon immersed in problems of his own, which included Chief White Half-Oat, who had been challenging him all that morning to Indian wrestle. And Yessarian, who decided right then and there to go crazy. "You're wasting your time," Dr. Nika was forced to tell him. "Can't you ground someone who's crazy?" "Oh, sure, I have to. There's a rule saying I have to ground anyone who's crazy." "Then why don't you ground me? I'm crazy." "Ask Clevenger." "Clevenger? Where is Clevenger? You find Clevenger and I'll ask him." "Then ask any of the others. They'll tell you how crazy I am." "They're crazy." "Then why don't you ground them?" "Why don't they ask me to ground them?" "Because they're crazy, that's why." "Of course they're crazy," Dr. Nika replied. "I just told you they're crazy, didn't I? And you can't let crazy people decide whether you're crazy or not, can you?" Yessarian looked at him soberly and tried another approach. "Is Orr crazy?" "He sure is," Dr. Nika said. "Can you ground him?" "I sure can, but first he has to ask me to. That's part of the rule." "Then why doesn't he ask you to?" "Because he's crazy," Dr. Nika said. "He has to be crazy to keep flying combat missions after all the close calls he's had. Sure, I can ground Orr, but first he has to ask me to." "That's all he has to do to be grounded?" "That's all. Let him ask me." "And then you can ground him," Yessarian asked. "No, then I can't ground him." "You mean there's a catch?" "Sure there's a catch," Dr. Nika replied. "Catch 22. Anyone who wants to get out of combat duty really isn't crazy." There was only one catch, and that was catch 22, which specified that the concern for one's own safety in the face of dangers that were real and immediate was the process of a rational mind. Orr was crazy and could be grounded. All he had to do was ask, and as soon as he did, he would no longer be crazy and would have to fly more missions. Orr would be crazy to fly more missions and sane if he didn't, but if he was sane, he had to fly them. If he flew them, he was crazy and didn't have to. But if he didn't want to, he was sane and had to. Yessarian was moved very deeply by the absolute simplicity of this clause of Catch-22 and let out a respectful whistle. "That's some catch, that Catch-22," he observed. "It's the best there is," Dr. Nika agreed. Yessarian saw it clearly in all its spinning reasonableness. There was an elliptical precision about its perfect pairs of parts that was graceful and shocking, like good modern art, and at times the Yessarian wasn't quite sure that he saw it at all, just the way he was never quite sure about good modern art, or about the flies Orr saw in Appleby's eyes. He had Orr's word to take for the flies in Appleby's eyes. "Oh, they're there all right." Sorry. Yep.
That is interesting. It's interesting because that's exactly what we were also discussing, that if his reactions, Yessarian's reactions and all of their reactions are perfectly rational, if you take into account that they are in a state of war.
Yeah.
And their lives, like when he says, "Everyone's trying to kill me," who's trying to kill me? He's like, "Oh, everyone." It's like, well, he's not wrong. Like,
yeah, it's I mean, I don't quite have the ability to unpack it, I don't think, but like that's the crux of the novel. I mean, that's the name of the novel right there, the idea that if you're crazy enough to be grounded, you will never ask to be grounded because crazy people don't think they're crazy. Exactly. And you know, if you want to keep flying missions, you are crazy and you can be grounded, but if you want to be grounded, then you're sane, so you need to fly more missions.
Yeah, it's a pain.
It's almost double think in a way.
It is. It's pure double think. It's ridiculous.
Okay, so we're now talking about the flies in Appleby's eyes. Oh, they're there, all right, Orr had assured him about the flies in Appleby's eyes after Yessarian's fist fight with Appleby in the officers' club, although he probably didn't even know it. That's why he can't see things as they really are. How come he doesn't know it? Inquired Yessarian. Because he's got flies in his eyes, Orr explained with exaggerated patience. How can he see he's got flies in his eyes if he's got flies in his eyes?
Okay, there's a point here. I wonder how much of Yessarian's frustration is because he's not understanding the idioms. He's very literal.
Oh, so, that scratch your back, flies in the eyes, yeah.
Yes, because that is not wrong. Like, when Orr is saying flies in the eyes, it's a distortion, or there's something that's wrong, or there's been thoughts that have been placed in there that distorts his ability to see things. Because the way that Orr just said, that's why he can't see things as they really are. Appleby is that dude who's super, super...
patriotic, yeah.
Patriotic and very much like, quote unquote, the example of a perfect American, quote, like, you know, that kind mm-hmm. of idea.
Yep.
The naive, not even naive, like just this completely righteous attitude. Yep. And if you go down, that makes sense. I think Orr actually makes sense. The problem here is we're getting this narrative through Yessarian's perspective.
And what Orr is saying right there is kind of a catch-22 as his own. You yes. know, when you've got flies in your eyes, you can't see that you have flies in your eyes.
Exactly.
It made as much sense as anything else, and Yessarian was willing to give Orr the benefit of the doubt because Orr was from the wilderness outside New York City and knew so much more about wildlife than Yessarian did. And because Orr, unlike Yessarian's mother, father, sister, brother, aunt, uncle, in-law, teacher, spiritual leader, legislator, neighbor, and newspaper, had never lied to him about anything crucial before. Yessarian had mulled his newfound knowledge about Appleby over in private for a day or two, and then decided, as a good deed, to pass the word along to Appleby himself. Oh, this is going to go well.
Yes.
Appleby, you've got flies in your eyes, he whispered helpfully as they passed by each other in the doorway of the parachute tent on the day of the weekly milk run to Parma. What? Appleby responded sharply, thrown into confusion by the fact that Yessarian had spoken to him at all. You've got flies in your eyes, Yessarian repeated. That's probably why you can't see them. Appleby retreated from Yessarian with a look of loathing bewilderment and sulked in silence until he was in the jeep with Habermeyer riding down the long straight road to the briefing room, where Major Danby, the fidgeting group operations officer, was awaiting to conduct the preliminary briefing with all the lead pilots, bombardiers, and navigators. Appleby spoke in a soft voice so that he would not be heard by the driver or by Captain Black, who was stretched out with his eyes closed in the front seat of the jeep. Havermeyer, he asked hesitantly, have I got flies in my eyes? Havermeyer blinked quizzically. Sties, he asked. No, flies, he was told. Havermeyer blinked again. Flies? In my eyes. You must be crazy, Havermeyer said. No, I'm not crazy. Yessarian's crazy. Just tell me if I've got flies in my eyes or not. Go ahead, I can take it. Havermeyer popped another piece of peanut brittle into his mouth and peered very closely into Appleby's eyes. I don't see any, he announced. Appleby heaved an immense sigh of relief. Havermeyer had tiny bits of peanut brittle adhering to his lips, chin, and cheeks. You've got peanut brittle crumbs on your face, Appleby remarked to him. I'd rather have peanut brittle crumbs on my face than flies in my eyes, Havermeyer retorted.
So I had to look up flies in the eyes because I know it exists as an idiom.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it's like that you are so blinded by your own viewpoints, you can't see the viewpoints are of others. You can't see if your own viewpoints and ideals leave you impossible to see the viewpoints and ideals of others.
Well, I'm also thinking, like, as a literal thing, the idea that a fly in your eye would be buzzing around and your attention would be completely focused on that rather than, like, what was right in front of you.
That's where it comes from. Like, that's the idea that it's not only what's in front of you, it distorts your vision. So it's the fact that it's referring to vision as a conceptual thing as opposed to a literal thing. But Habermas going literal about it is funny. And same with Appleby. Wow. Wow. And then Yossarian, you must be crazy. No, Yossarian's crazy. It's like...
Yep, everyone thinks everyone else is crazy.
Wow.
The officers of the other five planes in each flight arrived in trucks for the general briefing that took place 30 minutes later. The three enlisted men in each crew were not briefed at all, but were carried directly out on the airfield to the separate planes in which they were scheduled to fly that day, where they waited around with the ground crew until the officers with whom they had been scheduled to fly swung off the rattling tailgates of the trucks delivering them, and it was time to climb aboard and start up. Engines rolled over disgruntledly on lollipop-shaped hard stands, resisting first, then idling smoothly a while, and then the planes lumbered about and nosed forward lamely over the pebbled ground like sightless, stupid, crippled things until they taxied into line at the foot of the landing strip and took off swiftly, one behind the other, in a zooming, rising roar, banking slowly into formation over mottled treetops and circling the field at even speed until all the flights of six had been formed, and then setting course over cerulean water on the first leg of the journey to the target in northern Italy or France. The planes gained altitude steadily and were above 9,000 feet by the time they crossed into enemy territory. One of the surprising things always was the sense of calm and utter silence, broken only by the test rounds fired from the machine guns, by an occasional toneless, terse remark over the intercom, and at last by the sobering pronouncement of the bombardier in each plane that they were at the IP and about to turn toward the target. There was always sunshine, always a tiny sticking in the throat from the rarefied air. The BU-25s they flew in were stable, dependable, dull green ships with twin rudders and engines and wide wings. Their single fault, from where Yossarian sat as a bombardier, was the tight crawlway separating the bombardier's compartment in the plexiglass nose from the narrowest escape hatch. The crawlway was a narrow, square, cooled tunnel hollowed out beneath the flight controls, and a large man like Yossarian could squeeze through only with difficulty. A chubby, moon-faced navigator with little reptilian eyes and a pipe like Arfi's had trouble too, and Yossarian used to chase him back from the nose as they turned toward the target, now minutes away. There was a time of tension then, a time of waiting, with nothing to hear and nothing to see and nothing to do but wait as the anti-aircraft guns below took aim and made ready to knock them all sprawling into infinite sleep if they could.
Okay, so there's a few things. It's interesting they mentioned Avignon. Since the mess on the mission over Avignon, he had learned to detest every mammoth inch of it, because I think they must have had... Well, someone died.
Well, like remember how I talked about things kind of being colored in different spots? Like, before we just had a line about that Yossarian got into a fist fight with Appleby, and we haven't seen that yet, so maybe we learn about that later in the book.
This is the kind of thing where I'm suspecting someone sat down and actually highlighted the different stories using like a note and put it all together so they've got the stories by story as opposed to the way that it's kind of helps like all over the place.
Actually, yeah, that's a criticism. When I was looking into, I was doing some research on Catch-22 a week or two ago, and that was one of the main criticisms that people had about the movie that came out last year. It's either a movie or a TV series, but an adaptation. Apparently, the adaptation is chronological, whereas the book is just all over the place. So,
I think this is it's interesting because it does depict how, for some people, PTSD can be in the form of various flashbacks being triggered off, and I think that's what he's trying to depict. It doesn't look the same way. Like, you know, in TV and movies, they always depict it as flashback. It's very obvious. And they're back in the sick. And yes, a lot of people, that is what happens. And they feel the sensations. They smell the smells. Everything comes back to them like a Technicolor full immersive experience. Many people don't. Many people, it just becomes ingrained in their behavior and they respond to things without realizing they're responding to things and that the triggers. It's complex. how we respond. But it's interesting to read. I think that makes sense, that that's the way that Catch-22 is written, if given Joseph Heller has served, and this is heavily reflecting his experience. I think this is why he's writing this way.
And I guess, I do think it makes the narrative more interesting, but B, I think that's why so many people have trouble with it as well, because it's a nonlinear narrative.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, if the characters themselves, and also everyone thinks everyone else is crazy, Catch-22 is at the heart of it, the idea that if you're crazy, you can't be taken off because only a sane person would realize you're crazy. I mean,
yeah.
The way that time is back and forth and just everything's jumbled up, it really does feel a bit mad.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the madness of war. I understand that. Yeah.
The crawlway was Ysirian's lifeline to outside from a plane about to fall. But Ysirian swarted it with seething antagonism, reviled it as an obstacle put there by Providence as part of the plot that would destroy him. There was room for an additional escape hatch right there in the nose of the B-25, but there was no escape hatch. Instead, there was the crawlway, and since the mess on the mission over Avignon, he had learned to detest every mammoth inch of it, for it slung him seconds and seconds away from his parachute, which was too bulky to be taken up front with him, and seconds and seconds more after that away from the escape hatch on the floor between the rear of the elevated flight deck and the feet of the faceless top turret gunner mounted high above. Ysirian longed to be what Arthi could be once Ysirian had chased him back from the nose. Ysirian longed to sit on the floor in a huddled ball right on top of the escape hatch inside a sheltering igloo of extra flak suits that he would have been happy to carry along with him, his parachute already hooked to his harness where it belonged, one fist clenching the red-handled ripcord, one fist gripping the emergency hatch release that would spill him earthward into the air at the first dreadful squeal of destruction. That was where he wanted to be if he had to be there at all, instead of hung out there in front like some goddamn cantilevered goldfish in some goddamn cantilevered goldfish bowl while the goddamn foul black tears of flak were bursting and booming and billowing all around and above and below him in a climbing, cracking, staggered, banging, phantasmagorical, cosmological wickedness that jarred and tossed and shivered, clattered, and pierced and threatened to annihilate them all in one splinter of a second in one vast flash of fire.
Okay, just going to go back. So Ysirian sat...
He's in the nose because he's the pilot, I believe.
Yeah, he's the pilot.
He's got it. Arfi's the gunner, I believe.
I think so.
He's got a navigator as well.
Yep, so you've got... Single Fault was the tight crawlway. So his problem is that you've got that crawlway.
And he can't even wear his parachute. He has to... Like, if there was a problem, he'd have to crawl to the hatch, he'd have to put his parachute on, and then he'd have to open the hatch.
Yeah, and then get to the hatch, which is in a different location.
Meanwhile, the gunner is apparently sitting right on a hatch and is able to wear their parachute. And they have extra flak protection being in the gunner position as well.
That's fair, but, I mean, he's also saying, like, why don't they just put an escape hatch right there?
Mm-hmm.
There was room for it. But there's no escape hatch, which makes no sense.
Yeah. It could drive a man to drink.
Fair, yeah.
Okay, Arfi had been no use to Ysirian as a navigator or as anything else, and Ysirian drove him back from the nose vehemently each time so that they would not clutter up each other's way if they had to scramble suddenly for safety. Once Ysirian had driven him back from the nose, Arfi was free to cower on the floor where Ysirian longed to cower, but he stood bolt upright instead, with his stumpy arms resting comfortably on the backs of the pilots and co-pilot seats, pipe in hand, making affable small talk to McWatt and whoever happened to be co-pilot, and pointing out amusing trivia in the sky to the two men, who were too busy to be interested.
Okay, so wait, he's hanging out with the...
The pilots.
So where
he's
is...
He's the navigator. Arfi's the navigator.
Arfi's a navigator, but what is Ysirian?
Ysirian's pilot. I think McWatt's the co-pilot.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll find out as we go.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. And then Ysirian's getting pissed off and keeps chasing him out of there because he doesn't want him there because he's a risk to them.
Because he's telling them stories and they're like, man, we're on a bombing mission. We could get blown out of the sky any moment.
And he's also, I think he's a bit worried about him blocking the...
Yes. If something goes wrong, you're blocking my escape.
Yeah. Oh, what an ass. What an ass.
What a maroon?
No, what a just absolute ass. Like, really... Like if you're... just, why would you have someone who's disruptive? I think Isarian's actually in the right here.
For once.
Well, no, he's not wrong all the time. He's right. His justifications are a little bit wacky, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yes.
McWalt was too busy responding at the controls to Ysarian's strident instructions as Ysarian slipped the plane in on the bomb run and then whipped them all away violently around the ravenous pillars of exploding shells with curt, shrill, obscene commands to McWatt that were much like the anguished, intriguing nightmare yelpings of Hungry Joe in the dark. Arfi would puff reflectively on his pipe throughout the whole chaotic clash, gazing with unruffled curiosity at the war through McWatt's window as though it were a remote disturbance that could not affect him. Oh, Rue just inhaled deeply there.
Yeah.
This is not doing much to improve your impression of Arfi, is it?
No.
Arfi was a dedicated fraternity man who loved cheerleading and class reunions and did not have brains enough to be afraid.
Yeah.
Ysarian did have brains enough and was, and the only thing that stopped him from abandoning his post under fire and scurrying back through the crawlway like a yellow-bellied rat was his unwillingness to entrust the evasive action out of the target area to anybody else. There was nobody else in the world he would honor with so great a responsibility. There was nobody else he knew who was as big a coward. Ysarian was the best man in the group at evasive action, but had no idea why.
It's because he was afraid.
Yep. There was no established procedure for evasive action. All you needed was fear, and Ysarian had plenty of that. More fear than Orr or Hungry Joe. More fear than Dunbar, who had resigned himself submissively to the idea that he might die someday. Ysarian had not resigned himself to that idea, and he bolted for his life wildly on each mission the instant his bombs were away, hollering, "Hard, hard, 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 you bastard, hard!" at McWatt, and hating McWatt viciously all the time as though McWatt were to blame for their being up there at all to be rubbed out by strangers, and everybody else in the plane kept off the intercom, except for the pitiful time of the mess on the mission to Abaddon when Dobbs went crazy in midair and began weeping pathetically for help. Help him, Dobbs sobbed. Help him, help him. Help who? Help who? Called back Ysarian once he had plugged his headset back into the intercom system. After it had been jerked out when Dobbs wrestled the controls away from Hupple and hurled them all down suddenly into the deafening, paralyzing, horrifying dive which had plastered Ysarian helplessly to the ceiling of the plane by the top of his head and from which Hupple had rescued them just in time by seizing the controls back from Dobbs and leveling the ship out almost as suddenly right back in the middle of the buffeting layer of cacophonous flak from which they had escaped successfully only a moment before. Oh God, oh God, oh God, Ysarian had been pleading wordlessly as he dangled from the ceiling of the nose of the ship by the top of his head, unable to move. The bombardier, the bombardier, Dobbs answered in a cry when Ysarian spoke. He doesn't answer, he doesn't answer. Help the bombardier, help the bombardier. I'm the bombardier, Ysarian cried back at him. I'm the bombardier, I'm all right, I'm all right. Then help him, Dobbs begged. Help him, help him. And Snowden lay dying in back.
Okay, so following here.
Woo!
Yes, that got intense. So he does the evasive action. He's a pilot.
Yeah, so now we know what happened to Abaddon. Kind of.
So we have Dobbs going crazy mid-air and taking control.
So Dobbs is the co-pilot then?
Dobbs was, I think.
Was. Yeah, that's after that mission, definitely.
Yeah, I think it says here, it's like McWatt hating McWatt viciously the whole time as though McWatt were to blame for their being up there. So he's frustrated because they're still doing missions. But, And so when once they've released the bombs, he's like, let's get the heck out of here.
Mm.
Yep. Except that Dobbs went crazy mid-air because, obviously, Snowden was dying.
Mm-hmm. So he must have got shot or something.
Yeah, either Dobbs went crazy, and then Snowden died, or Snowden got shot or injured or whatever, and then that's why Dobbs went crazy. So it's going to be a little bit of untangling here.
Also, yeah, if you go into a tailspin and someone maybe isn't wearing their seatbelt or anything, G-force, and getting slammed around the cockpit or wherever they are on the plane.
Yeah, except for the fact that he said, help him, help him, help him. And he was saying, oh, the bombardier. And they're going, but the bombardier, like, Ed Nusseirin sees himself as the bombardier. The bombardier is the whole plane.
And I guess also, like we were talking before, of how the nonlinear structure of the book kind of echoes the madness of the situation, like the intense madness of that last scene in the chapter, you know, like you're trying to piece it together. And I was just powering forward when I was reading also, because the sentences were just ginormous. And yeah, I'm like, I need a break, building. I need a break. But, you know, it's just things are happening. You don't know what's happening, why it's happening, and you're just trying to get through it. I really felt that as I was reading it.
Yeah. It's interesting. Oh, wow.
So good to know. That a lot happened. Like, we got White Half-Out story, and at the end there, we kind of learned what happened in Avignon. We got the whole flies in the eyes, and we learned what Catch-22 is.
Yes. We learned Catch-22. We've got a lot more insights into, like, little glimpses into what happened.
Mm.
And that Arfi is a pain in the butt and needs to go.
He's up there with his pipe like, oh, isn't this splendid?
Yeah, it's just like, you are completely oblivious to what's actually going on here. You need to get out of here.
You could imagine him like the shell of a anti-aircraft gun could go out right next to the window. He's like, oh, look at that. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, it's like no, doesn't understand what's going on.
Well, as the book said, he didn't have brains enough to be afraid.
Yeah.
Whereas Yusserian is terrified, and that makes him the best at evasive action.
Well, the question also here is that, like, how was Dobbs before he went crazy?
Mm. Like, I have a feeling like every man who does one of these missions is on a razor's edge anyway.
Yeah, but I'm thinking with Arfi, I'm wondering how much of Arfi, like, was one of the other reasons that Yusserian doesn't want him there is because he's, aside from the fact that he'll block the tunnel,
he's another. He might be a replacement for Dobbs.
Yeah, I'm saying he's a replacement for, he's meant to be the navigator replacement for Dobbs, but the problem is that last time they had the navigator who was, maybe Dobbs had similarities with him, that Arfi and Dobbs have similarities in terms of, like, they're relaxed, they're laid back or whatever, they don't have that fear needed to survive.
Well, this just hit me there, and I think it explains the whole book.
Mm.
You go out on your first mission as a bombardier. You're getting shot at. You have to take evasive maneuvers. People are trying to kill you. Even in optimal circumstances, it's probably a pretty harrowing experience.
Yeah.
Then you get back down, and basically the next day, or whenever it is, brass is telling you, yep, now go do that again. Your life was almost forfeit. You probably already are stressed out of your head because of surviving that. And now do it again. And the next day, okay, go do it again. Go do it again. Once you do 50 of these, we'll let you go. Oh, you've done 50. We're not letting you go.
Mm. Yeah, it's a pain.
Just that constant stress piling up. Because one, it feels like one is bad enough. But you're making these poor folks do 50. And then you're not even letting them go.
And it's a pain in the ass. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I really feel for him.
Yeah, it's a real mess. Like, it'd be interesting to see if someone sat down. I want to see the series after this. That'll be the thing that probably makes everything make sense.
Mm.
That's the thing.
Well, I'm sure by the end of the book, everything will make sense.
Yes, I'm sure. Oh, wow. Okay.
It reminds me, actually, of... you remember the anime Fooly Cooly, FLCL?
Yes.
Where, for those of you who don't know, it was, I think, from 2001, 2002, it was a 6-episode series. It was very high-octane. The animation was just gorgeous, but the premise, the characters, where they lived, everything that was happening was very bizarre and very confusing. It was very wild. But the thing about that, for me, even in my early 20s, not being the smart person I am today, ha 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 ha, I say disparagingly. By the end of episode 6, I felt that series made perfect sense.
Mm.
It was weird, but like all the elements all came together. I'm like, yeah, no, I understand this.
It all puts together, yeah.
Mm.
Oh, wow.
And I have a feeling, I don't quite remember, but I have a feeling Catch-22 is the same. Like at the end of it, we'll be going, yeah, okay. If we were to go back and read it a second time right after me, it would all work.
It all clicks in. But yes. Oh, wow. Fascinating. But yes, so I think...
We had a lot of discussion about the chapter as it was happening. Maybe we both need like a break to decompress, and then next episode we can talk more about it at the start.
It's fascinating. I love the fact that Appleby is so literal, and the same goes with Havamar. And Havamar, I don't know. Havamar might have been just because he wants to shit stir. Havamar seems like he's like, at least I don't have flies in my eyes. Like, if you're saying he doesn't have literal flies in his eyes.
He might have thought that Appleby was making fun of him because Ysarion told him, and he knows Ysarion to be someone who
causes trouble.
Yeah, or at least from his perspective.
Well, yeah.
You know, the more time, I said this last episode, the more time we spend with Ysarion, the less I'm thinking of him as a purposeful shitster.
No, I think he does it without realizing that's what he's doing.
It's just his personality is doing that.
Well, he's very literal. He's like saying, you've got help. I need to help him. I need to tell him.
Yes.
You're like, what?
Oh, man. The whoever they got playing Ysarion in that adaptation, I think that's a very fine line you have to walk playing that character.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
You know, it almost feels like a better adaptation of this book would be from the Brits, because I think they can nail that humor.
Yes, it is their kind of cup of tea.
I wonder if there is a British, like a BBC or something, adaptation of it, even though it's an American novel.
I'm sure there is. I'm going to find it. It's like Wintergreen. And I like that, even Chief Half-Whitecoat's like, no, Wintergreen, he's a stinking little punk wise guy son of a bitch who ain't afraid of nobody. It's like,
Well, he certainly loves playing games with the generals, or at least General Peckham. He doesn't like General Peckham because General Peckham's communications are too prolix. Which we learned what means, like, overflowering language.
But also, wasn't it that Peckham... Who's the one who's actually the better tactician? It was Dreadle that was the better tactician.
Yes, yes. Peckham's kind of a... He's there because of family or you know, who
connections.
He is.
Connections. Yeah. He's a bloated, self-important fool.
He's like Stephen Fry's general in Blackadder season 4. Yep. That's who I see him as.
I can see that, yeah. He's just people. Yes. So in the meantime...
Yeah, I'll just say it seems now you're definitely warming up to
I'm
it.
A maybe, little bit, yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
Now that there's like a puzzle to unravel...
It's getting more interesting. Yeah, it's now I'm kind of getting used to the way that it's being written. It does take time. I can see why people would just stop at the first chapter.
Well, yeah, we're 5 chapters
in. Few chapters in. Yeah, so it's going to be a case of try and push through. It will make sense.
Come on this journey with us.
So good. It will make sense.
But yes. we'll leave it till then. The music at the top of the podcast is Soap Runs, composed by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Harry Gregson-Williams. That is from the 2019 adaptation of Catch-22. At the end of the podcast, the music is, as always, I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
And you can find me at RuMcMoo on Twitter. You can find our podcast at SMBSLT Podcast. That's on Twitter, on Facebook. And if you add an @gmail.com, that's our email address. And you can get in touch with us if you have any ideas and suggestions regarding books, any comments, any feedback on in terms of the podcast itself. And any thoughts, if you happen to be an author and you have a book you wouldn't mind us reading out loud and you think it would be our cup of tea, we are happy to do so as well. Just reach out.
Yeah, yep. Please do. So till next time, folks, you all keep well, keep safe, and enjoy your reading.
Mm-hmm.